Intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, welcome everyone here to a Dare to Think Out Loud, or as I commonly say, just dare to think instead of all your emotional claptrap. You might find out that there's a real world out there instead of one that is beset with lies and liars. Well, here we are on the 14th day of May in the year of 2021, moving into several months of absolute chaos and insanity. But we hope to offer a little bit of grounding here today. And I am joined by my good friend from out there in Arizona country, Cal Robbins, and Dave Scorpio, my producer from a little south of the equator. Brother Dave, how are you doing today?
Brother Mike, I'm doing good, man. Hanging in there in this crazy world. How about yourself?
Well, if I was any better, I'd be illegal, I am sure, and I may perhaps be illegal in a few locales. but we shall endeavor to persevere. Brother Cal, how are you out there in Arizona country?
I'm doing good out here. It's just getting warmer, and I'm just more and more trying to social distance from people because, yeah, I don't want to be around them.
Well, social distancing from idiots is a common practice I try to observe as often as possible, although I have noticed while driving on the highways, it's a little hard to do.
Most definitely difficult.
Well, today, Cal, I have bumped Cal around this week. I told him at first we were going to talk about Aaron Burr, and then I said John Francis Mercer, and then a few minutes ago I told him I wanted to lead off with a question. And so I want to ask this question for comments from Cal and from Dave, and especially for the people who might be listening, because I think this is a very critical question. And my question is this: would you accept, starting later this month, in any city that we could pick, would you accept a new constitutional convention where the delegates would be Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Michael Bloomberg, Donald Trump, a couple of Supreme Court justices, you know, let's take Chief Justice Roberts, and let's take a couple of millionaire judges. Judge Judy will do pretty good. I mean, she's on TV, gets $47 million a year. So let's put her on there, and then let's make sure that we get the owners of all of the major media outlets in this country, regardless of where they are. So we've combined millionaires, lawyers, judges, and the leaders and owners of the voice of the people. Pardon me, that's hard to say. The mainstream media. Would you gentlemen accept a constitution written by those people? Go first, Dave.
Well, I think that's a pretty accurate description of who would be at a constitutional convention, except for Donald Trump, because remember, he's playing the role of the masked wrestler you're supposed to hate. So I don't think they let him in. But I don't know, Mike, you know, given the way those people think, I think that's exactly the right crowd that would be there. And you would have something resembling what the World Economic Forum wants, because they've the oligarchy has become, consolidated into a monoculture, and pretty much all of them think exactly the same way. Because I think if you don't think a certain way, you're not going to be in the club.
Well, you know, I forgot to add Fauci and Gates to that list.
Definitely.
My pardons. I obviously forgot those two preeminent individuals. Dave, would you accept the finished product? If they wrote a constitution, would you be very happy to accept it?
No, I would not. I think, I think they're going to do an end run around this without the making a new constitution, but the result will be the same, which is a new system that's going to be very alien to most people. And unfortunately, from what I see, you see all the idiots wearing masks and doing what they're told like slaves. The vast majority of people will simply accept it as long as they think that they're going to get a little something out of it. But personally, no, I would not.
Would you call it inspired by God?
No, I'd call it inspired by someone else. No.
Cal, your comments. Would you accept that constitution?
No, I wouldn't. You forgot that they get to meet in secret.
Oh, yes. Obviously, they would meet in secret in some city, and they would meet in secret, and no one would know what was going on. Thanks for including that. But you would not be inclined to accept the constitution that they wrote, Cal?
No, I would not be inclined to accept it. Not at all. Not in the slightest.
Well, guys, that's exactly what happened 234 years ago.
Yes, it is.
The people that I named had different names back then. They had names like Washington, Madison, Gouverneur Morris, Robert Morris, Robert Yates. They had different names, but they were the same segment of society, exactly the same segment of society. And they wrote a constitution 234 years ago, and Americans today believe it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. But if you posed it as the question I just asked, if they would accept the same people from the same segment of society today, you know, and people say, well, who the hell would be Dr. Fauci? And I said, well, Benjamin Rush.
Yeah.
Okay, who would be the leaders of the media? Well, you know, back then, who owned the media? And you would find the people who owned the major newspapers were at the Constitutional Convention of 1787.
So, we'd have to add Greenspan in there too, then, or yes. Whoever the Federal Reserve Chairman is.
Yes, you would have to throw him in there, exactly. Because Hamilton was there, and that would be a like personality for sure.
Well, Janet Yellen would have to be there because she's been in charge of the Fed, and now she's in charge of the Treasury. I thought these were two completely separate institutions.
Well, yeah, well, that's what you get for thinking, Dave. You're going to have to give that up as a bad habit, my friend.
Dr. Fauci used to be Dr. Benjamin Franklin?
Well, Fauci is more like Benjamin Rush, I think.
Benjamin Rush. Okay.
Yeah. You know, I sat down yesterday and tried to draw up the similar characters who were at the convention. You know, and I am sure that, you know, you would intersperse that with a few people who were right thinking, like, you know, there would be have to be a Luther Martin. There would have to be a John Francis Mercer. And of course, an honest man like Patrick Henry would have said, you know, no way in hell I'm going to that. It smells like a rat to me. So we what I'm trying to do is draw up the same dynamic with today's personalities and the people who attended the Constitutional Convention of 1787 were exactly the same people, not by name, but by status and circumstance, exactly the same who wrote the Constitution of 1787. And I found the quote that I posted, Cal, from James Wilson, who became a member of the first U.S. Supreme Court, a strong Federalist. And he said that a Bill of Rights was both superfluous and absurd to add to the Constitution. Do you think that someone like, let's see, John Roberts or maybe Mark Zuckerberg would say the same thing in today's world?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I certainly think so. You know, this is part of our history that's been disguised from us, and we haven't, we don't see it. We don't understand it. That is exactly how we got this Constitution that everybody is all wrapped up in, believing that it protects their rights. Oh, we have constitutional rights. You know, and from that point, Cal, I would like to branch off into Mr. John Francis Mercer, who was a delegate from Maryland, along with Luther Martin and five other gentlemen. And
I... Before we do, can I one more small analogy?
Please, please.
Well, the analogy we would, you know, if you ask the people today to completely surrender the sovereignty of the United States to the United Nations, because that's what Virginia and Maryland and Georgia and South Carolina and Connecticut and all the other states, that's exactly what they did when they ratified the Constitution. They surrendered their sovereignty. It'd be the same thing as if today, hey, let's all get together and surrender the sovereignty of the United States completely to the United Nations. That's the analogy I make between the
excellent,
two.
Excellent analogy, Cal. Excellent. That is very, very prescient because that's exactly what they're doing, because back then the states gave up all the authority that they had. They gave up any control of government. They gave up everything to one centralized government. Now, let's take it just a bit farther, Cal and Dave. What if these people who wrote this Constitution then became president, vice president, the Supreme Court, and held the majority in Congress? Would you feel comfortable with that first Congress? Dave?
Yeah, no, I really see what you're getting at here. Yeah, the people that created the new system conveniently placed themselves in the seats of power. Yeah.
That is, and I believe that would be the exact thing because if these people we have mentioned drew up a new constitution and turned all of the power of this country, of the citizens of this country, over to the United Nations, as Cal so very well eloquently illustrated. If they did that, why would the people accept it? Well, if you want to know why the people would accept that in 1787, 1788, look around you today at all the people who are wearing masks. I believe that the dynamics of the situation in 1787 were no different than they are today. Different names. The people walking around had different names, but the analogy would be the same, because they were hit with all kind of propaganda. They were hit with, oh, the world's going to hell if we don't do something. Our country is broke. Our country is this. Our country is that. Of course, they created the problem, which would be analogous to what we're looking at today. The people who would get together to create a new constitution were the people who created the problems that the people would make the people accept a new constitution. So I see such a parallel with 1787 and 2021. So many of the dynamics are exactly the same. And the first thing you would do is you would criticize and be critical of anyone who criticized their arrangement. Like if you wanted to post something on Facebook or YouTube or one of the major media outlets being critical of what these men had drawn up, it just wouldn't be published, or it would be slanted, or it wouldn't, you know, it would appear in maybe three places, and you would be violating community standards if you tried to address the Constitution. Dave, look at the analogy and shoot holes in my theory, please, sir.
Well, I really can't. You know, the only thing I would add is that, you know, if anything, people are a lot more domesticated than they were, you know, back during the time of the Constitution. You know, we're all more dependent on the system. And I just think people are more docile. But even back then, people accepted it, which in a way makes things worse now, because this new system's going to be very, you know, draconian. But I think the vast majority of people will just simply accept it and say, hey, what can we do? We know we have to go along with it. That's how things are. You know, you don't want to make waves.
Well, have they not already accepted it with vaccines and masks, Dave?
Oh, yeah. It's right. The only problem is most people don't understand this is just the opening foray in a much bigger, you know, symphony that's coming. This is the opening act in the play, and most people don't see what's coming at them, but they just figure, well, things will get better, and if the powers that be want it that way, then we just have to go along and do what we're told.
Well, I think you also hit on another analogy, is that the Constitution of 1787 was just the beginning of the usurpation of powers that was conducted by the federal judicial system.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, Cal, your thoughts, buddy?
Well, it's through the judicial system that they were able to subordinate the states, make the states subordinate. That's where the states lost their power, was because the federal courts override the state courts.
Well, that's where John Francis Mercer comes in my opinion. John Francis Mercer, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, at the time in 1787, each state had their own judiciary. Each state seated their own grand and petit juries. And in each state, those juries had a right to rule on the facts and the law. In other words, a jury, grand or petit, could say, okay, well, you have charged this person under this law, but this law is unconstitutional. So therefore, your law is unconstitutional and the person you have charged is innocent. Well, John Francis Mercer very eloquently pointed out that they took, in the Constitutional Convention of 1787, they took this power away from the juries in the individual states and gave it to an unelected federal judiciary. So instead of the people sitting in as juries deciding the facts and the law of whether the law was constitutional or not, instead of that, they turned over all of that power to unelected federal judges. How in the hell could that ever be a good thing? Your thoughts on that, Cal?
Well, to completely understand that, people have to truly understand what justice really is. And what got set up wasn't a justice system, but a judicial system. something that would favor in according to what the laws are, which the supreme law is set up by the national head, as opposed to justice, in which is a search for truth. And they, that's what a jury does, is they look for the truth of all the matter, whatever's presented before them, and turn it into a judicial system to where it's whatever the laws say, whatever the bar and the lawyers say it says.
Well, Cal, let's draw up an example here. And Dave, I would really like your comments as well. I'm going to throw a hypothetical situation at you. It's Alabama. And of course, we have a good friend there, Jamie Bell, and our good friend DW. But let's say it's Alabama, and I'm doing this because it's historically significant. Okay, John Doe, or our good friend DW, or Jamie Bell, is charged in Alabama with carrying a concealed weapon or having a sawed-off shotgun or some other weapons charge. And they're charged with that, even if it is a federal crime, they're charged with it, but they go to trial in Alabama with a true jury of their peers. And in that trial, the jury decides, hey, not only is Jamie and DW innocent, but the law is unconstitutional. Because in our state constitution, it says the people have a right to keep and bear arms. So your law, not only is your not only are the defendants innocent, but your law is unconstitutional, and remove it from the statutes in the state of Alabama. Now, unfortunately, by the Constitution taking effect in 1787, this no longer is true. Now, instead of the jury, if a jury in Alabama made a similar verdict in today's world, and they say, okay, Jamie and DW, you are free to go, and the law is unconstitutional, I promise you it would be appealed to a federal court. Then an unelected federal judge would overrule the people of the state of Alabama. That federal judge may not even be in Alabama. But the federal judge would say, oh, no, it is constitutional because of the necessary and proper clause, and because of this, that, or the other, and the supremacy clause. So yes, it is constitutional. Yes, Jamie and DW, you're back in prison. Is that a proper analogy, Dave?
Well, yeah. And, you know, what's interesting, Mike, is I don't think a judge would even allow it to go as far as the very first step. Because the jury, they're not qualified. They, you know, they don't have membership to the Temple Bar in London, which is where really all this originates from. It's a, you know, sort of a club, or a, you know, you might even say a semi-secret society. Not many people even know about the Temple Bar, but that's where it all originates. And Mike, you know, it really makes this whole notion of so-called democracy really a paper tiger. You know, one thing that's always stuck in my mind was back in 2008 or 2009 when, you know, the citizens of California voted that, hey, we don't want gay marriage. Plain and simple, we don't want it. Even in California, right? They said no. And what happened? Well, a judge, I think from the Ninth Circuit, said, oh, that's unconstitutional, and struck it down. And then look, we have gay marriage all over the whole country now. And, this judge just happened to be a homosexual. No conflict of interest there at all.
Oh, I'm sure. I am absolutely sure. And I would bet any amount you would like to bet that that judge was unelected.
Exactly. It makes the whole notion of democracy really a paper tiger, and just sort of a joke, really.
Well, the Constitution was rigged and prepared purposely to make sure that the will of the people could always be overruled by an unelected federal employee. That is the Constitution you have today, people. That is the Constitution you think gives you rights. You do not understand it. You do not understand why it was prepared the way it was prepared. And stop and think of the scenario that we introduced at the very beginning of the characters who would be in a new constitutional convention. Do you think it would be any different today? Cal, your thoughts, my friend?
It seems to me anytime people in power get together, the people lose power. Every time Congress assembles, we lose more of our rights. So, yeah, when powerful people get together and start conspiring, red flags go off in my head all over the place.
Well, you know, those of us who are familiar with the early writings, Cal, know that this was what they planned before they even got to Philadelphia. They had been authorized by their states to go to Philadelphia to amend the Articles of Confederation. But you and I know, because we've read the source documents, the letters between these people, that they intended to totally overthrow this thing before they ever got there. And Washington, in a letter to John Jay in April of 1787, said, "Be almost beyond a doubt, what we are about to do is illegal." But they did it anyway. And as Alexander Hamilton said, we have to have a government of the wealthy and the well-born. So here we are, and we're looking at this today, and we're wondering how we got in this mess. And we still have people clinging hopelessly to the addiction to their own destruction, plugging our Sunday show. But this is exactly what the problem is. We got in this situation because of this Constitution, not because it was usurped, not because it wasn't followed. We got in this problem, we got in this fix because it was followed, according to the very plans of the people who wrote it. Can you shoot holes in that for me, please, Dave?
Well, no, Mike, I really can't. And I think the only difference today would be that the people are actually even more emboldened that are in power, because really we're at a point where they feel they own pretty much everything of any importance, all the institutions. And well, I guess that was true back then, but I do think they're more emboldened, and they're going to shove a system down people's throats that most people can't even imagine.
Well, Dave, here's a thought, and I thought about this as well. If you had been able to tell a group of people just a complete list of fabrications and lies, if you had told the people that three buildings crumbled to the ground on the same day because of a fire and because of jet fuel, that they crumbled to the ground, something that had never happened in history and will never happen since. And as the gentleman that we had on from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 said, that beams were blown 150 to 200 feet from the building. Now, that doesn't happen in a fire. But yet, the multitude of Americans believed that because they wanted to. They believe the government version because it made them comfortable. They couldn't fathom for a second the fact that their government was lying to them. 58,156 men and women perished in Vietnam over a lie called the Gulf of Tonkin incident that never occurred. You know, Admiral James Stockdale wrote in his book, he was flying CAP that night off the USS Coral Sea, I believe. And he said it never happened. He's a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient. He said it never happened. Why would you not believe him but believe the government? Where is their credibility, and where is Admiral Stockdale's? And of course, he's passed now. But where was his credibility? What about Korea? Another made-up fiasco. What about Iraq? Another made-up fiasco. Both times. Oh, they were throwing babies out of incubators. Proven to be an absolute lie. Oh, Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Yes, the ones we gave him to fight Iran. But the people believed it. They believed Oklahoma City. They believed the plandemic of a year ago. So, Dave, what would these people not believe?
Well, pretty much nothing. I think this is proof of it. You see the people with the masks and afraid of their own shadow. I think this is a huge test just to see how many people they can control. And just by using their, monitoring cameras and seeing that pretty much everyone around the world is wearing a mask, it's a good indication that the people are ready for a culling and ready for whatever they have planned. That's the sad part, Mike.
Dave, I'll never forget sitting in a meeting at Fort George G. Maryland at the No Such Agency, sitting in a meeting and listening to one of the top honchos actually say, of course, this wasn't about America at the time. We were doing it somewhere else. But I'll never forget what he said. He said, people, we can tell these simple bastards what we're going to do, and they still won't catch on. Now, is there any way you could defend that today? Could you say that about Americans?
Yeah, that's amazing, Mike. That's spot on.
Cal, your thoughts, my friend?
No, that's spot on. It's almost like they're required to, or they're gaming people when they tell you what they're going to do. This is what we're doing to you. And didn't some guy just say, in 10 years, you're not going to own property and you're going to like it?
Yes.
It's probably true. Unfortunately, he's probably right. I hate to say it, but he probably is right. Which is scary, but probably accurate.
Well, all you would have to do to get, people don't own property now, Cal. We know that.
That's true. We don't.
Yeah. Don't pay your taxes and see what happens to your precious property. The whole thing is such a fiasco, but the government can tell all of the lies they want to. And millions upon millions, hundreds of millions of people believe them without question. But try to tell this same group of people the truth and watch how quickly they become deranged and start telling you what kind of a crazy bastard you are. You're a conspiracy nut, damn it.
Well, yeah, Mike, and I noticed in the enemy war transmissions known as the mainstream media news, they're really hitting on this idea of how dangerous the internet is now. There's lots of, false information and misinformation and conspiracy theories. And, I don't know if you caught this, but both Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton are saying we need legislation to protect the people from all this awful misinformation on the internet, Mike.
Well, Hillary was saying that 20 years ago, Dave. She wanted a gateway, if you will remember, she wanted a gateway to the internet. In other words, you had to pass certain government regulations, certain government scrutiny before you would be allowed to use the internet.
Well, that's essentially what the Chinese have. You have an ID, a government ID that allows you to go on the internet. And if you break certain rules, you're simply cut off from the internet, period. And I think that's essentially what they want to unroll worldwide.
Well, would you believe they're going to do that with your vaccination card? If you don't have that ID, you're not going to be able to use the internet or to use any kind of electronic transfers of funds or anything else. That's on the horizon, guys. I firmly believe it's coming.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's going to be tied to your entire social credit system, if you have the right beliefs, the right behavior, what you've posted online previously. And yes, they're already setting up a two-tier system for the unvaccinated to have to sit in a different area if you want to go to a ball game. And, you know, the unvaccinated still have to wear their masks, but the vaccinated get to take their masks off. So yeah, the whole thing's going to revolve around vaccines and I believe a yearly vaccine.
Well, what was this thing that the CDC came up with? Oh, if you've been vaccinated and have your vaccination, you can not wear a mask indoors.
Yeah.
I don't
need if you don't have it, then you've got to wear a mask until you get your vaccine. So it's a carrot and a stick approach, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't need their freaking permission. I don't need the government's permission to breathe. But that is what they're telling us. If you want to breathe free, clean air, you need our permission. You must have jumped through our necessary hoops. You must have taken our population control inoculation. Did you guys see where Bill Maher, that wonderful socialist on TV, had his vaccinations and then had to cancel his show because he was ill?
No. Who was this?
Bill Maher, however you pronounce that idiot's name.
Oh, wow. I know. I didn't know that.
Yeah. He had to cancel a show because he was ill after taking the vaccine. I was surprised that they published that.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, that tells me now that they believe that they are so far in control and we are so far in the hole that we'll just accept it, even if we know it. You know, regardless of how many people dies, I think I saw where one of the leaders in India got on TV to take his vaccine so that he could show the people that it was not harmful, and he was dead 2 days later.
And, just a coincidence, Mike.
Oh, absolutely. You know, has nothing to do. What are we now, guys? Over 6,000 reported deaths from the vaccine?
Well, yeah, and here's the thing, you know, according to a Harvard study, only 1 in 100 damage events from the vaccine are being reported. So you can add 2 zeros to that to get the real number. But that's not all deaths. That's you know, negative reactions and health problems that are actually occurring.
Right. That's the, what they call that, the VAERS system or something like that, VAERS or something.
Yes,
of
yes.
That. Is that correct, Cal?
Yeah, that's correct. It just blows my mind that people can see this happening and they're still lining up clamoring for a vaccine. I don't understand. Like I say, I'll just do my social distancing. Y'all go do what you're going to do. Go thin yourselves, please. Hurry.
Well, I remember about 20 years ago when my wife told me I was a dinosaur. So I'm feeling even more like a dinosaur today. How about you, gentlemen?
Oh, absolutely, Mike. And, you know, that's why I think they've got this thing timed 10 years away. They'll want to make sure that enough of the oldsters are out of the picture before. Because really, you've got two generations of children, at least, that have been fully indoctrinated into what amounts to, you know, a communistic belief system, only they didn't tell them that's what it is.
Well, Dave, go ahead, Cal.
Well, that's just it. The younger generation, you know, the old guys like us, you know, we're going to be, you know, die off in a few years. And this new normal will be their normal. Only, I don't know, it'd probably be worse, but they won't know the difference.
Well, as an example, my wife was talking with our daughter yesterday, and the principal of our grandson's school called her and said, what do you want to do next year? Do you want to, because the school year is almost over, do you want to continue to do homeschooling with the Zoom classes as we had before, or do you want to have your child return to the classroom? And so my daughter asked him a few questions. Well, are they going to be required to wear masks? And his comment just absolutely is unreal. He said, we have children now who don't want to come to school without a mask. So it's going to be, do we allow them? Yes, they will be allowed to wear masks. So they have gotten to the younger generation, to these kids in school, to where a child now is afraid to go anywhere without a mask.
Well, there's actually a clinical thing called mask separation anxiety now. I mean, people cannot function without a mask on their face now. I'm so used to it.
Well, there's a whole lot of people can't function with a mask on their face. Most of them are in politics.
But they just, yeah, they compulsively just have to have a mask on. They do. They feel like they can't exist without it. You know, it's a separation anxiety they have from their mask.
Well, Cal, I think we're all like that. I mean, if we do something repetitively, even us old codgers, if we do something repetitively and then suddenly we don't do it, like something we wear, say, you know, we wear, you know, like for me, it's if I don't go out without my firearm, I feel naked. So there are things that we grow used to mentally as well as physically. And I think there is a natural inclination to feel something's wrong if you don't have it. And I think that is exactly what has happened with the mask situation. Would you agree, Cal?
Well, I would agree, but that's, you know, that's human nature. And that's one thing the powers that be understand is human nature and how it works. And they understand how to manipulate it. This is all they're doing. They're just manipulating the people to be docile, servitude slaves.
Well, guys, in your locales, you know, like I noticed, I went into two stores yesterday that had a sign up that said face coverings required. And of course, I didn't wear one. And I went in and walked around and I'm seeing a larger population than I saw a few months ago that aren't wearing masks at all. Are you gentlemen seeing the same thing in your areas?
There seem to be fewer people wearing masks. So, you know, those that don't want to really aren't, but there's still an awful lot wearing them.
Oh, yes, I agree. What about you, Dave, down there south of the equator? How are people reacting there?
Well, so far, most people are still wearing masks because they really haven't vaccinated hardly any people down here. You know, Ecuador only ordered like 200,000 doses of vaccine for a country of 25 million people. And the other interesting thing is that Ecuador is going with the Russian vaccine primarily and the Chinese vaccine, but I guess most of it's going to be the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. So right now I'm the only one pretty much that goes into a store without a mask. Most people have given up trying to tell me to put one on. I just ignore them. And, but yeah, unfortunately the docile people here just do what they're told. And, you know, that's where we are right now. But I've noticed they opened up a vaccine station in the little nearby town. And I haven't seen anybody, going into it. I mean, it's there's all these chairs there, completely empty. And, you know, they have a guy in a military uniform posted out front. Just like everywhere else, got to have the military involved here for some reason, but no people. So I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, yesterday I was on a program for 2 hours with Jim Ram, who is he has a company called Do It Yourself Health, or a branch of a company called Do It Yourself Health, and we commonly have a county commissioner from Ohio on the program with us, Brad Peoples. And he was talking about when the county health department came to a county commissioner's meeting and basically told the commissioners they were going to have to get busy and help them get people vaccinated because the people were reluctant and the county commissioners needed to push it. And my good friend Brad Peoples says, well, look, I'm not pushing anything I won't take myself. And so then the guy from the health department says, and what letters are behind your name? Because he's a doctor, and I love Brad. Brad said, well, the letters behind my name aren't fool, so I'm not taking your vaccine, and I'm not going to suggest to anyone else that they take your vaccine. And so then as we were talking yesterday on Jim's show, Jim was telling me, I haven't, you know, I believe Jim, he researches this stuff, but he said that now in Ohio that the governor has come out with a deal where if you're between the ages of 16 and 18 and you will go in and get the vaccine, you are entered into a lottery for free education in the Ohio college of your choice.
Well, also, Mike, they're also offering a lottery of $1 million.
Right,
in Ohio.
I heard that as well, yes.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know where this money's coming from. I guess it just magically appears from the state budget. They're just going to give away $1 million. I think there's five different prizes to try to coerce people into taking the vaccine. And, you know, going back to the school thing you were talking about, they're planning on having all children vaccinated for the school next year. They're already on clinical trials for children as young as 6 months old, if you can believe that. So the big question is, why is it so important that they vaccinate everyone, especially children who aren't even vulnerable to this case of the sniffles that's been going around? It's really quite incredible. So they're setting the stage. I guess my point is, for the next school year, your child will have to be COVID vaccinated. And they're already doing that for college students. So that's what's coming.
Well, I have no doubt about that. Cal, what are you hearing out in your neck of the woods, buddy?
Well, first off, I keep hearing it's not even really a vaccine. So what is it they're really trying to give people a shot for? Is my question. You know, if you get the shot and it really doesn't stop COVID anyway, what's the true intent behind everybody supposedly having to have this so-called vaccine?
Yeah,
that's my question.
Exactly. Well, that's the big question, isn't it?
When you alter someone's RNA, I mean, you're altering their humanity. I mean, it's almost like they're trying to make GMO humans, like GMO chickens or cows or something. A genetically modified organism.
Well, I think that's true.
You no longer have rights. You have what we say you have because you're really not a human.
Well, unfortunately, I believe that's true. And unfortunately, the people are going to march behind the Pied Piper right to their doom. Dave, I know you keep up with a lot of this. I wish we had Giuseppe with us. You keep up with a lot of this type stuff. I heard that Dr. Tenpenny has made some prognostications about how long the people are going to live after taking this thing. Are you familiar with that study?
Yeah, she's predicting there's going to be something like 30 million deaths in the next couple of years. You know, this all, to me, a lot of this is just speculation. I think that it has to play out slowly. You know, you're going to see, my personal view is that from the point of view of the conspirators, it has to play out a little more slowly. So there's no correlation between the vaccines and people dropping dead and getting all kinds of strange diseases. And that's already happening. You know, my favorite uncle took the vaccine because his daughter, my cousin, coerced him into doing it. She's a hotshot nurse at some hospital. And he has these strange pains in his legs now that the doctors can't figure out what's going on. I just think we're going to see a slow decline in health and all kinds of new diseases. And the other disturbing thing is something like 60% of so-called new COVID cases are people who are fully vaccinated. So go figure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's so much about this that just is so, should be so clear. I mean, you know, as I've said on some instances, it should be visible to Ray Charles. That this is just absolutely incredible. And yet the people, you know, when people see that 6,000 people and probably more, but conservatively speaking, 6,000 people have died from these vaccinations, not counting the ones who have become infirmed in one way or another, as you mentioned, your relative, Dave. And they see this, and yet they know, if they have paid any attention whatsoever. What's the current survival rate from COVID now, Dave? 99 point what?
99.7 something. It's really quite incredible how statistically low the death rate is, especially if you factor in that most people who so-called died from it had all these other comorbidities, you know, were 100 pounds overweight or already on death's door.
Yeah, that's one thing. I was out with my son in Iowa, and it just absolutely freaked me out. I saw a lady that had to be in the neighborhood. She might have been 5'7", 5'8", and I'm sure she was approaching 300 pounds. And as she approached the store, she was puffing on a cigarette and then got to the store and quickly put on her mask. Now, that to me is someone who is really, really, really worried about her health.
Oh yeah, Micah, I had this fat woman, I mean, easily 100 pounds overweight, tell me that I needed to put a mask on. And I had to bite my tongue from saying, well, you need to lose 100 pounds if you're worried about your weight. But I stopped myself.
Yeah, why? You just don't want to have fun anymore, do you, Dave?
I was in a good mood that day. I didn't want to spoil it.
Oh, okay. Well, hey, Cal, tell us something about John Francis Mercer.
John Francis Mercer, what he is believed to be the author of A Maryland Farmer in the Anti-Federalist Writings.
Correct.
He was a delegate from Maryland to the Constitutional Convention, and he wrote a list of suspected, either overtly or covertly, monarchists attending at the convention. That he wrote it for Luther Martin, I believe.
Yes.
And nobody's been able to source out and come up with that list yet. But I mean, looking through it, I can source out four or five that I know were monarchists at the convention, just from what they've written.
Well, let's stop and think about something here, Cal, and then we can throw this into that mix of what we started the program with. If these people who attended the Constitutional Convention, most of whom had become quite wealthy under the king. So if they had become as wealthy as they could under the King of England, why would they want to change the form of government to start with? But it is my contention that the people with the spirit who fought the war to gain their freedom were most influential at the Articles of in writing of the Articles of Confederation, and the monarchists who had become rich under King George wanted to get back that system of government which would provide their wealth. But here was the added bonus: they got to run it. They didn't have to depend on the king. They could run their own government. So is that a false dichotomy there, Cal?
No, I would concur with that completely. Yeah, that lays out exactly what they were doing.
That is, it brings up the point, and you and I have talked about it, how very, very difficult it is to get some of these documents anymore, and which makes me think back again to 1984, which also makes me very, very thankful that I made copies of so many of these source documents from the Library of Congress and the National Archives and the University of Virginia back in the 1980s, because I'm sure many of those are unavailable. But Cal, I think I mentioned to you that I saw where a good, really good historian, Merrill Jensen, had written, well, actually presented it, so I'm sure he had to write it first, had presented a program at Pacific University in 1936 about the Articles of Confederation, about the truth of the Articles of Confederation. And he had given this in a lecture at Pacific University, and it's not that long, you know, like 20-some pages, but try to find it. Because he just absolutely lays out the fact that Mike posited just a minute ago, that the people who wrote the Constitution were the people who wanted to return to a highly centralized monarchical form of government, that they would run, and they had to take back the freedoms that had been granted under the Articles of Confederation in order to make their system work. So I can see why they wouldn't want people reading that. Now, I was finally able, after about a 3.5 week effort, including an effort by my friend Mike Clifford up in northwestern Arkansas, who went to a couple of retired professors from the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville and asked them if they would attempt through their connections to try to get this article, this speech, lecture, and even they couldn't get it. So I was able to secure it, and I'm going to put it in PDF form. I am asking you two gentlemen now if you would like a copy.
Oh, definitely would love to have a copy.
Uh-oh, Dave doesn't want one. Well, I think he went to sleep on us anyway. We can't be picking on Dave like that. But yes, I will make sure that you get a copy, Cal. I tried to send it in a PDF. The first one I created, I tried to send it in a PDF to Mike Clifford, and the first page came through, the other were blank. So I'm working on that. Anyway, come back on the flip side with us, folks. Thank you.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, and there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came and also the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. That time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. And thanks for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud on this Friday in May. Dave, are you available, my friend?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
All right. How about telling the folks how they can help us continue this bastion of free speech?
Yes. Well, Mike, you know, as we all know, free speech is really under attack more than ever. They really want to crack down on the internet in general and squelch voices like ours. So come aboard Revolution Radio. That's at freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com. Or revolution.radio. Come aboard and become a Patreon member. Or there's also a Zazzle store where you can buy all kinds of cool stuff and help support the station. Or scroll down to the bottom of the front page and you'll see a physical address where you can mail in donations the old-fashioned way.
Oh, thanks, Dave. Cal, I got a question for you. You all set?
Shoot, what do you got?
All right. Are you familiar with anyone other than Mr. Mercer, John Francis Mercer? Are you familiar with anyone other than him pointing out the perils of a representative democracy?
The perils of it?
Yes.
Yeah, Sentinel pointed it out, but and so did Brutus, but they were more referencing in the landmass, and there were just too many people to have a republic in such a large space. A republic is contingent upon a smaller group of people. I mean, for this country now to be properly a republic, you would have at least 300 separate republics, at least. And that's only because of modern technology and we can communicate now where they could before. But in order to have a proper Confederation of Republics, it would take at least 300 separate republics just in the continental landmass of the United States now.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that would be just to understand a republic, a proper functional republic.
How would you respond to the allegation that the Constitution of 1787, 1788 destroyed 13 republics?
Oh, I would say definitely. I mean, prior to that, it was a confederation of 13 republics. Each state was its own republic. And as each state got bigger, as Virginia was growing, they knew they had to separate out. And that's how you ended up with Kentucky, because they knew that it could only get so big, and then it would have to separate out, because that's how representation works, which is exactly why this constitutional republic, so-called constitutional republic, in the scheme of republics, does not function as a republic. It functions as an oligarchy.
Well, we say...
That's just the science of understanding governments.
Well, many times I've heard people say, well, we are a representative democracy, we are a representative republic, but John Francis Mercer delved into that in great detail, and he stated that there is absolutely no way that you can elect a person to represent the will of all of his or her constituents. Of course, it was his constituents back then, that was an effort in futility. Yeah. That the person that was elected to represent the people would harm more people than they ever represented. Is that not true today?
Exactly.
So he attacked even that part of the government that everybody points to as being a positive today. Because, you know, do you believe for a moment that your representative, Cal, actually gives a damn about what you think about government?
No, and if I said something to him on Facebook, he kicked me off his site. Yeah, no, he doesn't care.
Well, the same thing that Mercer talked about. He said the problem with a representative republic or a representative democracy would be that only the wealthy and well-born would ever be able to obtain that high office. Is there any member of the U.S. Congress or the U.S. Senate right now who is just a common workaday 40 to 60 hour employee who just went out there and made a living and tried to provide for their family? Are there any of those in Congress?
Nope.
Well, then if there's not any of those in Congress, how the hell can they represent those people?
I don't think there ever has been, in at least in the 20th century, has there?
Not to my knowledge. I don't, a common person, just a everyday workaday Joe Sixpack, as they were called, has no chance whatsoever of being elected to public office. I'm talking about on the national level. And then our Constitution said we should have one representative for every 40,000, and George Washington opposed that and said, well, let's draft it down to 30,000 to have a representative for every 30,000 people, and now we have a representative for every 780,000 people. Now, you have to be living in a la-la land to believe that one person can represent the wishes of 780,000 people. What they do represent is the segment of society which gives them large campaign contributions. That's who they represent. And people today, especially, you know, these wonderful Republicans, believe that if they could just elect another Republican to Congress, they could fix this damn thing. And when has that ever worked? How many times in my lifetime have I seen a Republican president with a Republican majority Congress? And they have been just as deadly to the people's rights as the other party with a majority. Any argument there, gentlemen?
None for me. I agree with that completely. It was designed to be that way, though.
By those wonderful Federalists in 1787, right, Cal?
Yep.
Well, I guess, too, you have to have access to, you know, millions of dollars somehow to get elected to anything beyond, you know, county dog catcher or something like that. So that's part of the reason it works.
Well, even our quasi-friend, Terry. Terry said that he lost the election for city council in Parker, Colorado, because his opposition raised more dark money and spent $7 per vote for city council.
Wow. How many, what was the total he spent, you know?
I do not know. I didn't delve into it any further. Terry was just telling me I asked him about how his election fared, and he said the opposition came in with too much dark money. And if they are willing to buy votes at $7 a piece in a city council election, they're willing to spend that kind of money. How in Hades does a common, ordinary, everyday Joe citizen stand a chance of being in a position to influence the laws under which we are governed?
Well, yeah, and Terry doesn't even live in a big city, does he?
No.
Yeah.
That's exactly my point. When they are willing to spend that kind of money at that level, what chance does anyone have of true representation? And yesterday we had a conversation again on the program with on Eurofolk Radio with Jim Ram. We had the conversation where I brought up something that a Republican had done, and Jim said, "Well, he's a rhino. He's a Republican in name only." And I said, "Okay, Jim, tell me a Republican, name a Republican that is not a rhino."
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, this last Wednesday, we had Paul English on the show with some other guests. And, you know, Paul made the very concise and excellent point that if you have a bank that's controlled by, you know, external entities and, you know, able to print money, do what they want, everything else is really secondary. You don't have control of anything as long as that is the case. And that's really the truth. And all the things that you talk about with Alexander Hamilton and going back to the beginning of the Constitution, it's the same as today as it was then.
Absolutely. And I was thinking, as I was reading, doing some in-depth study on Aaron Burr over the past week or so, including two older books published in the early 1900s. I was amazed at how little things have changed. In 1794, Albert Gallatin was elected senator from the state of Pennsylvania. And Albert Gallatin had immigrated from Switzerland. And early on, when he was 17 years old, and he had immigrated. But in Pennsylvania, he very much was a promoter, or you might even say an instigator, of the Whiskey Rebellion. And so he is elected senator in 1794. And Alexander Hamilton and the Federalists opposed his election to the Senate, saying he hadn't been a citizen of the United States long enough to have that office. And then the Federalist-controlled Senate voted him out of office and said he couldn't be there because he hadn't been that citizen. He hadn't been there long enough. And ironically, in that hearing, the senator from New York, one of the senators from New York named Aaron Burr, made the comment, because Alexander Hamilton was there at the Senate helping the fight against Gallatin. And good old Aaron Burr said to the mass of the U.S. Senate, "Well, guys, here we have with us today the Secretary of Treasury, who arrived in America from a foreign country after Mr. Gallatin. How can he be Secretary of Treasury?" Rather interesting, wouldn't you say, Cal?
Oh, definitely interesting. How many years had Gallatin been in the United States?
It was hard to determine exactly when he arrived, so that ended up being a point of contention. Of course, you know, he didn't have any record of when he actually arrived, but he arrived in New York, spent some time in New York working to get enough money, moved to Pennsylvania. And then, of course, Gallatin becomes a big friend of Aaron Burr. But Gallatin was also a financial wizard. And Gallatin, even though he was kicked out of the Senate after winning in 1794, the next year he was elected to the Congress, to the House of Representatives from Pennsylvania. So Hamilton was again foiled in his attempt to try to keep Gallatin out. But ironically, Gallatin is the longest sitting Secretary of Treasury in U.S. history, because he became the Secretary of Treasury under Thomas Jefferson and remained through 8 years. He left at the end of the term of James Madison. So there, Gallatin, there's another figure in history that we aren't taught very much about at all. But he was a financial wizard, and he helped, actually helped Thomas Jefferson in his first term to reduce the size of the bureaucracy and to reduce the taxes on the people, which hasn't happened since. So, Cal, what do you know about Aaron Burr from your wonderful public school system education?
From school, you learn that, well, he shot Alexander Hamilton. Basically, that's it. He was a vice president to Thomas Jefferson, and he shot Alexander Hamilton in a duel. That's pretty much the extent of it. And in researching Burr, after you said this is what we were doing, it's difficult to find stuff on him. I mean, I was digging and digging and digging. I'm just glad you've got those two books from, what were the turn of the 20th century when they were written, so that there's actually some information on him. And my spidey senses, so to speak, go up when there's a lack of information on certain things. And so it's like, what are they trying to hide? So I'm waiting for you to enlighten us on more on Aaron Burr.
Well, Burr is certainly a fascinating study, I promise you. And just as you, the only thing I had heard about Aaron Burr was that he had shot Alexander Hamilton and killed Alexander Hamilton. And my first thought was, I'm really upset at Aaron Burr. Not that he killed Alexander Hamilton, but that he took so damn long to do it. You know, if he would have taken care of Hamilton back about 15 years earlier, we might not have had the mess that we have in this country today. But, you know, that's just wishful thinking. But Burr was a Revolutionary War soldier. He was involved in the attack on Toronto during the Revolutionary War and during the winter, which proved to be a huge folly. And, of course, the general he served under, Montgomery, was killed. And Burr became quite ill in that winter from lack of food and what have you. He resigned his commission. And Burr was actually, and I had never heard this before, and I've been trying to document it, Cal and Dave, but I was read in one of those books that Aaron Burr was actually offered a position as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, but he turned it down. Now, that would have had to come out of New York, because that's where he was from. And again, I'm trying to document that, because when I say these things, I like to have at least two sources, so I try to research it. But I would be really kind of wondering why he turned down the opportunity to be at the Constitutional Convention of 1787. But the one thing that becomes quite clear is that Jefferson, by the time the Federalists got to 1798 with their Alien and Sedition Act and their other stuff, there was a big schism in America between the people in America who supported France, like Jefferson, and the people in America who supported England, like Adams and Washington and many others, Hamilton, of course. So it became a political battle between those factions. And of course, we had the Quasi War that occurred during that time frame. Hamilton was doing everything he could to influence Adams into declaring war against France, which was, why? And I believe he was operating again under his British masters to promote that war against France. Adams refuses and actually kind of sets out some peace feelers toward France. And then Hamilton starts blasting Adams about being weak and, not a good leader and what have you. So Hamilton wants to run someone who will push his agenda rather than Adams. And so he reverts to Charles Pinckney of South Carolina, who, we've got a Southerner. He also wants a Southerner to take votes away from Jefferson because Hamilton and Jefferson hated each other. So he wants to keep Jefferson out of office. And the person who turned, and I think the evidence is clear, the person who turned the 1800 election to Jefferson because he had no support in the North, the person who turned the support in favor of Jefferson in 1800 was Aaron Burr. Because Jefferson was absolutely pilloried in the Northern press during the 1800 election. It was said that, number one, if he was elected, he would burn all the Bibles in the Northeast. He would burn all of the Puritan Bibles, that he was a heathen, that he would probably sell out to France or maybe have a French Revolution in America. He was accused of all of these things in the Northeast. But Aaron Burr, through some brilliant electioneering, prior to which had never been heard of in America, through some brilliant electioneering, Aaron Burr turns the state of New York for Thomas Jefferson in 1800, and he turns the majority of the electors in Pennsylvania for Thomas Jefferson. It's safe to say Thomas Jefferson would never have been elected president without the assistance of Aaron Burr. Of course, Aaron Burr was also running, was a candidate. And back then, it was the person with the most votes gets to be president, and the person with the second most votes gets to be vice president, regardless of what political affiliation they had. So the 1800 election was the first election that kind of divided the people along party lines. And Jefferson's party was known as the Democratic Republicans. And of course, by this time, good old blows in the wind, James Madison had switched parties. He had left the Federalist and had gone over to Jefferson's party and was supporting Jefferson as well. But the electioneering that took place there was just absolutely unreal. I mean, you had previously had John Adams as president and Thomas Jefferson as vice president. There were even some deals that were made to switch the two in the 1800 election and let Jefferson be president. And, to study that election and to compare it with the 2020 election is kind of fun. But anyway, the election ends up in the House of Representatives as it should have been, just like the 2000 election should have been, and the 2020 election should have gone to the House of Representatives. But, of course, it didn't. On 36 votes in the House of Representatives, they still had a tie. And it was a tie between Jefferson and Aaron Burr. So the story is, and there's two sides to this, Cal and Dave, and I don't know which to believe, but one side of the argument says that Jefferson sent an emissary to James Baird of Delaware and offered a political appointment to one of his cohorts if Baird would switch his vote to Jefferson from Burr. And then there is the other side of the story that came from Baird's side, which says that Baird initiated the meeting between Jefferson and Baird and offered that he would sit out the next vote, which would be a no vote, which would mean Jefferson would win if Jefferson would appoint his friend to this high political office. Afterwards, Jefferson denies such a deal ever happened from either way, from either side. But those two points are in effect there. So Jefferson becomes president and Aaron Burr is vice president in the 1800 election. So Dave or Cal, any questions so far as we move to this point?
No. Go ahead, Cal.
Well, I was going to add, okay, because elections back then were different, it was, you know, whoever got the most votes was president, second place was vice president. And in the 1800 election, Adams actually came in third place, so he was out of it, with Burr and Jefferson tying in the amount of total votes. So then they throw it all out. It goes to the House. The House now votes amongst itself who's going to be president. Are Burr and Jefferson of the same Republican-Democrat party, or is Burr aligned more towards Adams or more towards Jefferson? I mean, it's kind of like a third party. He's kind of like the third party guy.
Well,
Jefferson's like the opposite of Adams, but Burr's up there as, you know, the second place guy. Trying to put that into modern context, where would Burr have rated back then? The third guy. He's like the Ross Perot.
Well, everything that Burr had done up to that point would indicate he was a strong advocate of Jefferson's position of the Democrat Republicans.
Okay.
Okay, but
you had two people with same ideology,
right?
Burr and Jefferson. Okay,
but by doing so in New York and in Philadelphia, turning the election away from John Adams in a heavily Federalist society, which was New England, by doing so, Aaron Burr created a plethora of enemies. Because they realized that Jefferson, no way in hell would Jefferson be president. And these were the people who were saying he was going to burn all the Bibles. He was going to, they tried every approach that they could. But they fully realized that Jefferson would not have won the election without Burr's help. So the Federalists up north turned on Burr with a vengeance. Then these same people in the newspapers who were writing negative stories about Jefferson then started writing negative stories about Aaron Burr, including marriage infidelity, including the fact that he was a homosexual. I mean, they did not let up on Burr at all. The Federalists went after him like a chicken after a June bug. But ironically, Jefferson and Madison did not support him. He's vice president of the United States. Jefferson nor Madison stepped up or voiced any support for the very man who helped Jefferson get elected.
And Madison was Secretary of State.
Madison was Secretary of State, and the communication between Madison and Jefferson indicates that Madison and Jefferson wanted Madison to follow Jefferson as the next president. That's why he was put in the position of Secretary of State. And they were concerned that Burr might have enough support up north and in the South now to become the next president, and they wanted to prevent that at all costs. They wanted to keep the power within their southern structure. So Burr got left out to dry by both sides of the issue. But his efforts, when he was, whenever there was a Senate back then, when there was anything to do with the Senate holding special hearings or what have you, the vice president sat at the chair of those meetings. And there were several contentious issues of which Aaron Burr played a very prominent part with the Senate, including, and but most of them were on the side of, on the side of what we would call rightful liberty. He stood up for the rights of the people. But again, he was not going to get any support from the Southern contingency, and the Federalists were attacking him on a daily level. I would compare the attacks on Aaron Burr in from 1801 to 1804 with the attacks on Donald Trump from 16 to 20. It was just a constant barrage. Every day it was some other story on Aaron Burr. And so Alexander Hamilton jumps into the fray and starts publishing what is just untruths about Aaron Burr. But we have to look back at Burr had caused Alexander Hamilton's father-in-law, Philip Schuyler, had caused him to lose power in New York and elective office. So there was a lot of animosity from Hamilton. So Hamilton jumps on the bandwagon and starts accusing Burr of things he had not done. So Burr gives him the opportunity to take it back. Three separate occasions. Mr. Hamilton, you can say that you were misquoted. You can do whatever you want. Here are your opportunities. So he was presented three different times with the opportunity to back up on the false statements he had made about Aaron Burr. And so after his third refusal, Burr challenged him to a duel. Now, it's important to remember, Burr was still vice president. When Burr killed Alexander Hamilton, he was vice president of the United States. So when they had the, they rode across the river to Weehawken, New Jersey, in separate boats with their seconds, and they had the duel, and again, there's conflicting reports. Burr's side says Alexander Hamilton fired first. Hamilton's second said that Aaron Burr fired first. Well, regardless, Burr hits Hamilton with a mortal wound. Hamilton doesn't die until the next day. But he still had a musket ball lodged in his spine. So he dies. Well, guess what happened? The state of New York issued an indictment against Aaron Burr for murder of Alexander Hamilton, which quickly falls apart when Aaron Burr mentions to the people of New York, the shooting took place in New Jersey. You have no jurisdiction. Plus, in the state of New Jersey, dueling was still legal. So then after New York drops their case of murder against Aaron Burr, New Jersey files a case of murder against Aaron Burr in a duel which is permitted by state law. So is that kind of an idea of how the Federalists were going after Burr during that tenure, Cal?
Yeah, it sounds like they were after him, and he kind of was his own worst enemy in some ways, so to speak. Just for standing on his own principle.
Well, very much so. Any comments, Dave? What do you see in this situation?
I'm just enjoying the conversation. Aaron Burr really is sort of a mysterious character, because you know he got involved in some scandals, and Jefferson was going to testify against him, and then he didn't. So it's hard to get a real reading on, what Aaron Burr was. Of course, anyone that killed Alexander Hamilton can't be all bad.
Yes, sir.
Do you know who the seconds were for Burr and for Hamilton?
Not right off the top of my head. I know who they were historically, but they are names that that we probably would not be common everyday names to the American public.
I just wondered, because I knew Hamilton stood in as a second for some other duel and was able to get him to stand down. I can't remember that whole story.
I think it would be interesting also, before we get, and I should have included this, pardon me, I should have brought this up, but that James Monroe challenged Alexander Hamilton to a duel prior to this. When Monroe was in the Senate, someone comes to James Monroe and provides documents to where Alexander Hamilton, as Secretary of Treasury, had paid out blackmail or ransom in some way, not actually ransom, but had paid blackmail bribes to one James Reynolds. So Monroe suddenly has these documents showing where, as Secretary of Treasury, that Hamilton was paying someone to keep quiet. So Monroe initiates an investigation in the Senate. And of course, Aaron Burr is president of the Senate as vice president. So this investigation takes place, and Alexander Hamilton contacts James Madison and says, look, let's meet in private and I will explain this, because I need to protect someone's reputation. So Monroe agrees. So Monroe meets with him, and it's unclear as to where Aaron Burr was there or not at this meeting. But anyway, at this meeting, Alexander Hamilton says, look, this is not a bribe. This is not a political bribe. He says, I was having an affair with James Reynolds' wife, and he found out about it, so I started paying him a bribe to keep it quiet. Interesting enough, in the bribe was also the condition that Hamilton could continue his affair with Reynolds' wife. So Hamilton beseeches James Monroe to protect the reputation of a lady, Ms. Reynolds, that this not be made public. And James Monroe agrees. And so James Monroe lets it slide. But somewhere, someone else got wind of this, or the documents of this bribe, and brought it up and made it public. Hamilton is beside himself with anger and accuses Monroe of allowing the documents to fall into other hands and impugn his character. So he accused Monroe. Monroe felt like it was falsely done. So Monroe challenges Alexander Hamilton to a duel. So Aaron Burr was instrumental in getting that stopped. Ironically, you know, I've thought many times that a miniseries, a true miniseries of the true history of the founding of this country would be absolutely a fantastic program. What do you think, Cal?
Oh, yeah. I was just listening to the drama there. I'm just like, wow, this would... I was watching the show play off in my head already. Yeah, it would be a fun miniseries with the plot, subplots, and the affairs.
All of the stuff that's happening. And, yeah. Alexander Hamilton's son was killed in a duel.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Same dueling pistols, too, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
With the very same dueling pistols.
I think so.
Yeah.
Those dueling pistols are now owned by a bank in New York. But after he kills Hamilton, And after fighting through two indictments for murder, and of course, he realizes to be a candidate for president is absolutely an impossibility because both sides have turned on him. So he then teams up with the leader of the United States military, a General Wilkinson. He teams up with him and they go out, look at the Mississippi. They go look at various places. They go into the down to New Orleans. They have a meeting down there and what have you. And so then Wilkinson provides to Thomas Jefferson documents which he says proves that Aaron Burr is committing treason and plans to get the southern states to secede from the Union and to attack the northern and to take over the entire country. And Aaron Burr intends to be king with his castle in New Orleans. And so Jefferson believes this. He doesn't verify it with any other sources, according to what is out there right now. He doesn't, but he is ready to go after Burr again, because, again, they feared Burr. So he's ready to go after Burr. So that is when Jefferson tells the Congress, and it's printed in the media, that he has irrefutable evidence that Burr committed treason. Well, it wasn't learned until years later that General Wilkinson at that time was under the employ of the nation of Spain. Spain was paying Wilkinson a monthly stipend, if you will. So he was under the employ of a foreign power while he was the commanding general of America's military. But Jefferson believed him. Jefferson says, I have irrefutable evidence. I can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Burr is a traitor. So Burr is eventually apprehended in Kentucky. And as soon as he is apprehended in Kentucky, allegedly for treason, Kentucky indicts him for murdering Alexander Hamilton. So he gets the old double whammy again. Pardon me.
How could they indict him for murder? What was dueling illegal at that time in Kentucky?
Well, Dave, they had no authority whatsoever to indict him for murder. But it helped their case for treason, so they indicted him for murder, too. I don't think
Right, of course. Just like today.
Yes, exactly. Just like today. I will indict you for so many charges, you'll plead guilty to something just to get the hell out of it. So right, that was basically the philosophy then. Eventually, it ends up in a trial. And, of course, Aaron Burr represents himself. Edmund Randolph, the former Attorney General of the United States, helps Burr as on his legal team, and so does Luther Martin. But Jefferson, as president, runs the prosecution. Totally unconstitutional. He appoints the attorneys that he wants to be the prosecutors of Burr. So the way I look at it, poor Burr was stuck here because he had created enemies of both branches of both political parties, and he was stuck in the middle without a doubt. But anyway, it gets to, and guess who is the judge? Cal?
That would be Marshall, wasn't it?
Yes, John Marshall is the judge who has no good feelings toward Jefferson, his cousin. He has no feelings whatsoever towards Jefferson. He does not like him at all. They do not like each other. So here is Marshall sitting as the judge, and Burr, being the absolute excellent attorney that he proved himself to be, attacks the case on the constitutional definition of treason, Article 3, Section 3. And there was no way in hell that they could prove that case. But Luther Martin, in his appeal to the court, says that the case is nothing because the president of the United States, or it's highly tainted, because the president of the United States had declared Mr. Burr guilty before he was even charged with a crime. And that the president himself was engineering the prosecution of Mr. Burr. And then Aaron Burr subpoenas the documents. What do they call that? Tacus dictum? Something like that. He makes the legal appeal for the documents in the possession of the president, and he also petitions the president to testify at the trial. Jefferson declares executive privilege and says he will not appear at the trial. And then he says that he will provide some of the documents, but not all. He will withhold some of the other documents for, get this, guys, national security purposes. So Jefferson gets very angry at Luther Martin again because of his saying that the president has already tried and convicted my client before he was even accused, before he was even arrested or indicted. Jefferson gets very upset at Luther Martin and calls him in the media a Federalist bulldog that should be put down. What do you think of this drama, Dave? Wouldn't this be a cool movie?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised one hasn't been made. And I was just thinking, too, while you were talking, the kind of, courage it would take to actually be in a duel like that. Those were large caliber, the dueling pistol shot a pretty large caliber bullet out of him, and it was pretty much curtains if you got hit between just instant death or, infection of some kind. So I'll tell you, that must have been... you had to be pretty courageous to go through with it and not just shoot your mouth off like people do now.
Exactly. I would love to see a duel between Gates and Fauci. But I'm sure they're both safe because probably neither one of them knows how to operate a firearm. But I don't want to get away from the story. So, Cal, any comments up until the point that Luther Martin is a Federalist bulldog that needs to be put down?
I think it kind of points out to how even someone as Jefferson, once they end up with power, even as president, his first term, he was okay. This was during Jefferson's second term, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it just, power changes a person. And that's quite obvious in how counter to this all, how un-Jeffersonian all of this seems to be for Jefferson.
Exactly. And I believe it's that political thing because I believe Jefferson was still concerned, as was Madison, that Burr would come back and run for president again. And so what better way to make sure he couldn't run against Madison for president in 1808? What better way to ensure that than to have the number one opponent in their minds, because they did not see a strong opponent anywhere else. They knew Hamilton couldn't run. Adams was through. They didn't see a strong Federalist candidate anywhere. So the only strong candidate at that time that Jefferson considered was DeWitt Clinton, which was George Clinton's nephew, I believe. And he was a senator from New York at that time, if I'm not mistaken. And that was the only tough candidate they saw to compete against Madison. And they wanted to make sure that they ensured Madison's victory and a continuation of their party program.
Who did compete against Madison? Was it DeWitt Clinton?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, they tried to get Robert Yates and John Lansing because Yates became a Federalist after he wrote all of his Brutus papers. Yates actually ran, they actually tried to get Yates to run for governor of New York with Hamilton as his chief supporter in 1789.
Wow, what plot twists there are in here.
Yes, it's absolutely intriguing. It's better than any TV show, I promise you.
So, it is the truth.
Yes, that is the really good part. But Jefferson absolutely gets beside himself angry when he hears that during the trial, the judge, John Marshall, attended dinners where the defendant was. So there were people giving Burr dinners during his trial. Of course, Burr had to stay in one, you know, in one house. He was under, some form of arrest or detention. He had to stay in the house, but it didn't keep the people from having large dinner parties for him during the trial. And Jefferson went batshit crazy when he found out that John Marshall had attended some of the dinners. So, yeah, this is quite the drama. It is very, very, very entertaining. So, yes, they wanted to make sure that Burr could not be a political opponent, that he had been basically neutered as a political opponent. And between the between Jefferson's faction and the Federalist faction, he was negated as any form of a candidate whatsoever. So any thoughts, Cal?
I just, like I said, it's fascinating to learn about Burr because this is like missing in history. And we're still trying to piece together the full story because there's so many plot twists to this story, you know, differences in allegiances from Federalist to Anti-Federalist, Anti-Federalist to Federalist. It gets confusing at times, just even for someone, you know, I study this stuff, and it's still kind of confusing at times.
Yeah, you almost need a scorecard, huh?
Just about.
Well, it's Burr. Then, you know, after he is found not guilty because of his asking Marshall kind of flip-flopped a little bit too, because during the trial, Marshall threatened to use the English definition of treason as opposed to the definition in the Constitution about treason. But also, there were, you know, two things kind of on a personal level. Aaron Burr married Theodosia, was his wife's name. And of course, they had a daughter and they named her Theodosia. And his wife, Theodosia, she dies. And from all of the description, everything that people seem to think looking back at her symptoms and everything, she died possibly of cancer. Of some form. And then, of course, Burr was heartbroken. That was the love of his life. But he had named his daughter Theodosia, and she ends up marrying one of the richest men in the state of South Carolina. And she has a son that they named after Aaron Burr. And I'm trying to think if it was Prevost, Aaron Burr, Prevost, something like that. And of course, at the age of 11, his namesake dies unexpectedly. Burr is heartbroken over that. And then shortly thereafter, he asks his daughter Theodosia to bring all of his, he kept all kind of manuscripts. He had all kind of notes. He had diaries. He had all kind of things that he kept. And he asked Theodosia to bring those to him, and she was on a schooner headed to bring those things to him, and was lost at sea in a terrible storm. So a lot of Burr's documentation went away with that loss. But Burr had some tragedy in his life, and it surely seemed to affect him as he got older. Any thoughts, Dave?
Well, that's tragic. I didn't know that both his wife and his daughter passed away like that. Did he ever remarry?
Yes, when he was just a couple of years before he died. I think he was near 80, and he married a very rich lady in her 50s. Of course, Burr was Burr was known as quite the ladies' man.
And yeah, you got to respect that.
He was like 5'6". Oh, gosh. Program's over, guys. I'm sorry. Come back and visit with us next week. Air.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero X E 0513. We talk about